Good evening. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here. I'm Matt Winters. Welcome to Columbia Forum. We're nearing the end of the season, and I'm really happy to be here to introduce a longtime friend, and I'll get to that shortly. Columbia Forum is sponsored by the Daily Astorian, Craft 3, the OSU Seafood Center, KMUN-FM, and Cannery Pier Hotel. Thanks to all of them for hosting this invaluable community institution. And so to have somebody that actually knows what they're doing in the world, and as Bob does, he's one of the nation's world's most renowned experts on butterflies, for one thing, Sasquatch being another. I'm sure he'll just love your questions and comments about Sasquatch. To be able to wander around with someone like Bob and actually be able to be told, you know, what that really is and what its place is in the natural habitat is just such a gift. And that's the legacy that Bob has given us with his extensive library now of books that will be a lasting testament to his wisdom about our natural world. So no further ado, welcome to Dr. Robert Michael Pyle, Bob Pyle, as he's much better known.
Like the letters I get from somewhere at the beach every week with fake handwriting, you get those? The hearing aid letters. Looks like a personal letter. Might have to talk to them, Graham. Well, good evening. I'm so happy to be back at the Columbia Forum. The last time I spoke at the Columbia, and Matt, what a sweet introduction. You're a very sweet man. Thank you. I would like to thank the members of the Fourth, is it the Fourth Estate? Is that what we call the press? Let's thank the members of the Fourth Estate, including KMUN, for our wonderful. We're so lucky with newspapers here, still real newspapers in Clatsop County, Pacific County, and Wakayakum County. But the last time I spoke at the Columbia Forum, which was here, and then for a while we were over at the Red Building, right, I think? But the last time I spoke here, at Steve's invitation, was on Darwin's birthday. I don't remember the year, but I think it was the year after Darwin died. And my topic was, you're a good man, Charlie Darwin. Well, it's entirely different this time. I'm not speaking about Darwin. I'm not speaking much about butterflies. And I'm not speaking about Bigfoot. Although, the question and answer period is fair game. My topic tonight is wit, war, and wonder. The place of poems in a prose writer's life. Now, before you all get up and leave at the mention of poetry,
or prose,
I'm going to whip this out.
He's got a gun.
Cheerleader's gone again.
Thank you.
Well, if you ain't got the do re mi, boys, if you ain't got the do re mi, well, you better get back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Georgia, Kansas, Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden. It's a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do re mi, boys. Believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do re mi. Thank you. Now contrast Woody Guthrie's little poem, and there's a little more to it than that. Poem, song, same thing. A song is a poem with a melody. But that's the heart of it. And contrast Woody Guthrie's little song with Steinbeck's epic Grapes of Wrath. Now, which one better tells the tale of the haves and the have-nots in the 1930s? Tom Joad and his like. Answer, they both do, but one is a little more concise than the other. And that's just one reason why a writer of essays and novels might want to pursue poetry too. Now, though known chiefly as a writer of prose, most of those door stoppers over there are books of prose, nonfiction prose. I have always written poems as well. Well, that's if always goes back at least to fourth grade. In fourth grade, I had an amazing teacher in Aurora, Colorado, at Peoria Elementary. Her name was Maud Lindstrom Franson. And Maud Franson was remarkable in many ways. Among them was the fact that she had written some books, which to me was awesome. But also, she had written our textbook, our fourth grade textbook. It was called Our Colorado Blue Book. And every fourth grade class in the state used it. And she was our teacher. So I was pretty impressed. And I liked my books. But more than that, Mrs. Franson cared about nature. She taught us about conservation and what it meant to her. And if she recognized a bud of interest in these topics in a student, as she did in me, it brought an undisguised blush of delight. And when we wrote poetry in Mrs. Franson's class, as we were encouraged to do, particularly with nature and conservation as subjects, she would write it down, or she would ask us to write it down in a black book that she kept for the purpose, and to illustrate it with crayons or colored pencils. She entitled the book Treasures, a collection of poems written and illustrated by my pupils in grades 4 and 5. Now, I went to see Mrs. Franson. I was giving a reading from The Thunder Tree, which takes place, is set there in Aurora, and at the Aurora Historical Society. And another one of my teachers, my sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Franson, came. I mean, Mrs. Ferguson. And I asked her about Mrs. Franson. I said, I heard she'd passed. And she said, oh, no. She's still alive. She lives up in Thornton. She's nearing 100. So I went to see her. And when I did, she whipped out that black book. And we read the poetry of Leslie Coxey, John Culley, Ray Dichter, Bobby Pyle, et al. And we read several of them together, remembering my classmates, her students. And when it came time to leave, Mrs. Franson said she was eager to have me back when it was cool enough for coffee in her kitchen, her Swedish idea of proper hospitality. But the following winter, she died. And a few months later, I received a package in the post opening it, I found the candy box, the black book, and the poem. In the forest lives the deer, brave, bold, and sincere. In the forest lives the porcupine, on his back his shiny spines. In the forest lives the bear, he looks like a hunk of hair. In the forest lives the skunk, with a stripe on his back like a little chipmunk. In the forest lives the raccoon, washing his food by the light of the moon. Bobby Pyle, 1956-57. 19-frogging-56. Mrs. Franson had said, "I think of you as the little boy of long ago." Feature it. Well, I'm no longer sure about the brave and bold part, except so far as both are synonyms for survival. Or sincere, except as all wild animals are infinitely sincere, knowing nothing else. Or, on reexamination, my poem offers little promise of a literary career, I think you'll agree. Nor had I yet given up the common practice of calling all animals he, which would, of course, lead to their imminent extinction. But the point was, when asked to write, I wrote this. And it may be the first nature writing I ever attempted. So I'm glad to speak with you here tonight, Your Honor, your editorships and publisherships, your radioship. Thank you for KMUN being here, and everyone else. Thank you so much for coming to talk about this topic, which is Wit, War, and Wonder, the Place of Poems in a Prose Writer's Life. My serious devotion to writing poetry in my adult life dates from December of 1994, at the last reading of the year at Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle, when I heard Barry Lopez read a poem by Patty Ann Rogers. Patty Ann Rogers is one of our foremost American poets who writes in an idiom that gives full rein to what she calls the more than human, other species besides ourselves, as well as the human heart. Patty Ann, on next Monday, is receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award, a special John Burroughs Medal, only the first time that the John Burroughs Association has recognized poetry since 1937. And she's receiving this award in New York. I was supposed to be there, but I couldn't go. I'm happy to be here with you instead, but that makes me very happy that she is, because this is the poem that I heard Barry Lopez read at Elliott Bay in 1994. It's called The Hummingbird, A Seduction. If I were a female hummingbird, perched still and quiet on an upper myrtle branch in the spring afternoon, and if you were a male alone in the whole heaven before me, having parted yourself for me from cedar top and honeysuckle stem and earth down, your body hovering in midair, far away from jewelweed, thistle, and bee balm, and if I watched how you fell plummeting before me, and how you rose again and fell with such mastery that I believed for a moment you were the sky, and the red-marked bird diving inside your circumference was just the physical revelation of the light's most perfect desire. And if I saw your sweeping and sucking performance of swirling egg and semen in the air, the weaving, twisting vision of red petal and nectar and soaring rump, the rush of your wing and its grand confusion of arcing and splitting, created completely out of nothing, just for me. Then, when you came down to me, I would call you my own spinning bloom of ruby sage, my funneling, the storm of sunlit sperm and pollen, my only breathless piece of scarlet sky. And I would bless the base of each of your feathers and touch the tine of string muscles binding your wings and taste the odor of your glistening oils and hunt the honey in your crimson flare. And I would take you and take you and take you deep into any kind of nest you ever wanted. Who wouldn't want to write that? It set off a spark in me to go back to poetry. I'd written some very bad poems over the years from time to time, but hearing that poem that night, I can take it right back there to wanting to become a better poet, become a person to whom poetry meant a lot in one's life. I started reading it a lot more and writing more. And then a remarkable thing happened, because I've always been a freelancer, or for many, many years, I was available, so I got to go on what were called the Forgotten Language Tours, which were barnstorming tours of writers put on by the Orion Society. We would go to a particular part of the country and go to colleges and bookstores and pubs and churches and Grange halls and whoever would have us to give readings. And most of the poetry and prose and fiction that was read had to do with people, yes, but people and the rest of natural history. And I got to go on a number of those Forgotten Language Tours, including one where we came right here to Seaview. And I was traveling with Patty Ann Rogers and with Allison Deming, the head of ultimately the Arizona Poetry Center, and Kim Stafford, the great poet from Portland, the son of William Stafford, and other fine poets and prose writers. And this was very special. I got to hear their cadences and their stories in miniature over and over again. I wanted to do what they did. I read my essays, but I was working on poetry, and finally I hazarded a poem at one of the readings, and I began to read that poem at our readings. And this is the first poem that I dared to read to those poets on a Forgotten Language Tour. It's called Ride On, Leave the Driving to Us. Ride on, big gray dog, ride on. Ride on, you long metal box on wheels, ride on, ride on. Ride on, people of the alleys, streets, and farm towns, you mothers with small children eating baby Ruths for dinner, ride on. Ride on, old man with useless legs, losing your pants as you slide down the steps for a smoke when the rest get out for theirs, ride on. Ride on, you scarred black man, blonde woman, so loud, your profane repartee so loud in the back of the big gray dog, where you found a refuge and an entourage, your laughs so loud and cackling in the dark, ride on. Young roofer who asks me for pen and paper and draws tattoos, almost speechless, hungry, downing chips and coke on my $2, ride on. Ride, handsome boy, with the journal, never out of Oregon, to your fiancé in Florida. Ride, old hippie with a club foot and braces. Ride, you goateed philosopher dumpster diver, with heroic B.O., reading Umberto Eco and telling your grinning seatmate about the Old and New Testaments and how Jesus loved Mary Magdalene, him telling you about CIA sex slaves. Ride on. Ride, dog, ride. Ride to the sordid lean-tos, squalid stations, the Denny's, the McDonald's, the Baker City truck corral, where the drivers always have the same tables and waitresses. Ride through heavy rain and moonrise, heat and sunset, past fawn, pronghorns, and white pelicans. Ride, you old woman with two coats who wants to buy lipstick and gets up for your stop hours early every time, blocking the aisle. Ride, you young woman with heartburn who gives the old one your lipstick and cradles your silent, hungry child. Right on, you consternated patient drivers, with your service pins and gray pressed suits and weary patter, remembering the strike and the snipers and dying to retire, who change in Denver, Salt Lake, Boise, Portland. Right on, right on, right on, right on. Ride, night dog, ride, day dog. You man with the small girl who slept barefooted and pillowless on the bare, dirty floor in the chaos of the Denver Depot, who holds her now in the back among the loud, coarse, happy riders. Ride on. You young, pretty mother with two little boys and dirty pillows going all the way to Michigan, and you bawling babies heading three nights to some other place. Ride on and on. Right on, you teenage girl in long black velvet gown with tattered hem and no shoes, met by two police cars in Ogden, smiling and waving back at your new friends. You people who joke about the drugs you've known and don't have, who rush out at every stop into spontaneous combustion of the drug you do, ride on. Ride, roofer, ride. Ride, writer. You weepers, laughers, coughers, ride. All you who ride and ride and ride the big gray dog. Ride on, little Latina, your mother across the aisle, your brother behind, your sweet brown head pressed into my side. Ride on. Well, I got some reaction, and it made me want to write more. You know, prose and poetry complement one another. Florence Sage and I visited the village in Iceland where a man named Snorri Sturluson in about 1220 wrote the prose variations of the great poetic Eddas, the ancient divine mythology of the North. Both the prose version and the epic poems carried forward the heroic beginnings of the Norse and Icelanders. We learned also that the poetic tradition carries on today in many an Icelandic farmhouse, and posted this sweet verse on the wall of the Keflavik Airport outside Reykjavik by Petur Gunnarsson. On Earth's part, all days start beautifully. Patiently, it revolves and revolves with its trees and oceans and lakes, deserts and volcanoes. The two of us and the rest of you and all the animals. That's become my favorite grace. I'll be with my stepdaughter and her family in Milwaukee for Easter, and I will say this grace before our little lambykins join the table. I'll say, the two of us and the rest of you and all the animals. You can't really say that in an essay. Just as prose and poetry can be sister endeavors, so do poetry and science go together. Vladimir Nabokov, the great novelist and also butterfly scientist, knew this when he said this. Put my book away too soon. Nabokov said, "Does there not exist a high ridge where the mountainside of scientific knowledge Does there not exist a high ridge where the mountainside of scientific knowledge joins the opposite slope of artistic imagination?" That's where Nabokov wanted to live, and he did, practicing both science and literature. And that's where I wanted to live, and that's why I named this book, Walking the High Ridge. But Nabokov wasn't the only one who felt that. Goethe, too, felt that poetry was necessary to understand the mysteries of the natural world. Darwin praised Humboldt for his rare union of poetry with science, which Darwin practiced too, as in his Tangled Bank passage in The Origin. Thoreau also followed Humboldt's belief in the deeply seated bond between knowledge and poetry. As Thoreau put it, a true account of the actual is the rarest poetry. And Henry David Thoreau spent his whole time at Walden and beyond trying to link the territory of the heart and the imagination with that of science and the intellect. And Rachel Carson is as beloved for her lyricism as she is admired for her revolutionary science that changed the world. We wouldn't have all the ospreys around here and bald eagles without Rachel Carson, you know that. So there you have six of my main idols and models: Carson, Nabokov, Thoreau, Goethe, Humboldt, and Darwin, all praising, seeking, and finding on the page and in the mind, on the page and on the land, that high ridge between science and art. And as a scientist myself, I still do some science. I just had a big peer-reviewed paper published I've been working on for a long time, just published. Do a little science on the side still. But as a scientist who both writes and reads poetry, I find that the two seldom conflict and often concord and absolutely need each other, allowing me to exercise both my intellect and my imagination. Or, as my writer, painter, forester friend Neil Johansson puts it, the right combination of head bone and hormone. Now, over the years, I slowly built a body of poems, being asked by Florence to read at the River Theater Poetry Series, whose right name was The Monday Mic for Spoken Word. Does anybody remember that great series at the River Theater? Well, you should. I know some of you were there from time to time. Memory is short. But that was my first full poetry reading ever, and it was both terrifying and liberating. And it emboldened me to hone my work for my first collection, Evolution of the Genus Iris, and then the second, Chinook and Chanterelle. And now, Rick's Mic, our wonderful first Tuesday open mic at Winecraft, where you're all welcome to come and hear and or read. And Rain Magazine, great patron of the local poetic arts, and my poetry pal, sweetheart, and mentor, Florence, and the flawed and fabulous world around us all keep me going, poem to poem. Here's one from Chinook and Chanterelle. The Room of Lost Items. You might relate. What if you opened a door and there was a room with everything you'd ever lost? The paper flowers you made for your mother that blew away in the snow. All the jackets you left on buses, that scab. The hats alone would fill a long shelf. The heather purple deerstalker left on a double decker. The 3X beaver Stetson Smoky somewhere in Alaska. The Haas Cartwright 10 gallon that badly needed losing. Remember that beautiful scarf left in the lecture hall? The binoculars that were part of your body for 40 years? The wallets, the gloves, all those things you promised not to lose. And then you walk through this door, and they're all here. Oh, the joy! That special sock, that kitten, those keys. But wait, there are people in here too, and versions of your heart in several shapes and states. And the deal is, you have to take them all. So why poems anyway? Poetry can be a quick response to any event or aspect of life for which prose takes just too damn long to write or read. But that is illusory, for a good poem can take as long to get right as a long essay. I've written many more drafts of poems back and back and back than some of my essays, which perhaps needed more. Still, poetry compresses the power of prose into the lyric concision of a song. For example, this iambic rant, composed by me with music by Chris Novoselic. We have a little combo called Butterfly Launches from Sparpole. We're going to put a record out soon with a dozen songs that we've done together, but I recite the lyrics instead of singing them. And I'm sorry, Chris isn't here to play the beautiful song that he composed with this poem. As I say, it's an iambic rant. The entire thing's iambic pentameter. And it's local issues that you will recognize. And I could have written a long essay about it, but I didn't. It's called Unintended Consequences. To make the channel deep for ships, the Army Corps pumped out the sand from riverbed and stacked it up in spoil islands in midstream. And to the new hotels of sand came cormorants and terns to nest, and then they fed their chicks on salmon smolts. To save the lions of the sea, the NOAA said they can't be shot, and so their numbers grew and grew, and all the docks are swaddled with their blubbered bulks. The airways clogged with barks and roars, and lions eat their fill of salmon up the gorge. So now the Army Corps is shooting birds and oiling nests, and bogus orca bellies up instead of scaring lions off, and one sea lion basks upon its floating wreck as others of its kind get shot beneath the dam. Everything we touch comes back to haunt the best laid plans, as every timorous beast comes home to eat the hand that shoots it. People of the river towns look on and shake their heads and mutter, how in hell did those guys get it wrong again, and turn away and hawk and spit. And so I think of every double-crested cormorant that came and bred because we made the habitat, of every lion of the sea that fouls a dock or eats a fish because we gave it what it needs, and how we're going to take it back and give them both hot lead instead and claim the fish and take the dock and make the fix. And then, guess what? We'll start the whole damn thing again to make the channel deep for ships. Little old lady who swallowed a fly, huh? Oh, that was one of the best pictures ever in the Daily A, was the upended fake orca with the sea lion basking on his belly. That was a coup. Now, I said I would concentrate on three elements, war, wit, war, and wonder. And as I wind down toward the end, I'm finally getting to my topic. As for wit, where would we be without it? Even farther up the creek than we are. Just consider the great outpouring at the Fisher Poets Gathering each year, this 20th event being no exception, just passed. There are many grim and dramatic narratives to be shared each year at Fisher Poets, but it's seldom too long between chuckles, which keep it all bearable. If poetry doesn't strike you as funny, hearkening back to the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner or Thanatopsis, just think of limericks. Every one of them a story. In fact, my first pay as a poet was for a limerick. I was working in Cambridge at the time, and I was attending the Cambridge Zoology Department open house. The prize was £5. And I won. And that was my rent. £5 a week for my cottage at the time. But I took it to the pub instead and stood pints for all the zoologists. Here's the limerick. At one point on the voyage of the Beagle, Charles Darwin was nabbed by an eagle. He cried, "Oh, what a pinch! A Galapagos finch would be gentler if slightly less regal." There weren't too many entries. Now, we don't have to go looking for wit. It comes to us if our eyes are open and our imagination lively. Here are three shorties, each a little gift from the come what may, wrapped, I hope, in a smile. The girl with cockleburrs in her hair. It's not a Swedish noir novel. We were talking about how children don't get out anymore. She showed me her daughter on her cell phone. Big pout and four big burrs caught up in her hair. "That girl," I said, "is going to be okay." Dancing pants. The blue cotton panties and white cotton briefs dance in the warm air of the heat vent, swing back and forth, up and down on drying rack bars. Perpetual motion in the nether regions. Tireless. Don't their owners wish their pants would always dance like that at the mere lick of hot breath? And we got to have one cat poem. There are so many. It's probably as many cat poems as there are cat videos. Just one. This is called The Gift. Lawnmower rumbles through June-long grass. Pot gray overcast blocks any sense of summer. Black-capped chickadees work unfolding oaks. Robin plucks and swallows red huckleberries. Cat lies by ivy's curl, sated by one large vole, yet watching for another, ever hopeful that he might once again approach back door, give that guttural purr or sexual snarl that means, "See what a gift I bring for you," and receive approval that is all his to ignore. You know, sometimes we have to laugh just to keep from crying. And that surely applies to the everyday news. No offense to the papers or the radio station. So I was doing a writing retreat at the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology in the Oregon coast. And each evening after I worked, I would go walking down to the estuary of the Salmon River below Cascade Head, north of Lincoln City. This is called All Things Considered. Two river otters fished the salmon, diving and rising side by side, almost down to the surf, watching their sleek and pointy loop-de-loop over and over and over. I managed to miss the evening news. And so for war, that almost ever-present bane that has blighted all of our lives and many other lives much more than ours. The Iraqi invasions gave rise to a great Poets Against the War movement led by Washington poet Sam Hamill and others. And it moved me to write these two. Pink Pavements. How the sidewalks flush and run when the cherries, crabs, and apples shed their petal pelts. How exploded blossoms soften concrete and stone. In Colorado, nights before track meets, I walked and walked, dreaming of Olympus, holding in the exhalations of Hopa crabs that lined our streets. Next day, the same cold wind that always blew my discus down too soon would strew the streets with pale pink discs. In Cambridge, cherry blossoms daubed the rosy fronts of colleges, scented stale doorways of pubs, memories of winter on harsh fen breath, stripped set fruits of flower, laid pink silk over ancient pavements, lifting skirts and dressing lanes in time for the May balls. Even now, when hard spring wind unclothes the cherries in town and crabapples thicken the night air, I feel the blunt rim of the discus on my fingers, the cool rim of the pint on my lips, and I think, as yet another April whiles itself away in war, how the pavements of Baghdad must go pink, spattered with the petals of peaches and plums when the car bombs burst, how blossoms soften exploded concrete and bone. And this one was inspired by the Chinook Observer, the next one. But you might wish I hadn't seen it. No, all praise to the newspaper for reporting the facts. Until I come from the rainforest, unlike you rain shadow people. Do you know we get 20 to 40 inches more right across the river than you get, right? It's true. Yeah. This is called the paintball war. Do you remember that? No, maybe before your time, I'm not sure. But, pardon?
I've been there forever.
Yeah, you have. Well, this one has a epigraph or gram, I always forget which it is, from Alfred Lord Tennyson, the charge of the Light Brigade, in which it says, "All in the Valley of Death rode the 600. Into the city watershed rode the 80, National Guard and local lads and dads. Theirs not to reason why, theirs but to have a good time. In full battle regalia rode the 80, camo and goggles and hunting gear, armed with the mighty paintball guns, each the other to smite and smear, to simulate gore, to show who killed the other. Into the forest rode the 80, and a good time was had by all. 2 hours, 2 skirmishes, 20,000 rounds of paint, on to each other and into the groundwater. It was just like a real battle, said the warriors, except that all the 80 rode back. Onto the scene dropped the engines of war, 2 big Blackhawks. All looked up in awe when the helicopters landed. A great experience for the local kids, said the paper. And this came to pass at Christmas time, as troops and weapons were building up into the Gulf. Into the Gulf went a boy I know, who used to hunt butterflies with me, gone to guard prisoners of the coming war. We wish, said his parents, Christmas card, he'd never traded his butterfly net for a machine gun. He came back okay. He's a wildlife biologist now. Well, what can poets do to stop the wars? Same as you, only witness and write and hope and vote. They sure can't hurt. And some maybe can do more, like Lorca or Neruda or Valesa. We can even link war and wit, unlikely as it sounds. Hey, after all, think of Catch-22 or MASH. Do you know Aristophanes' wonderful comic play, Lysistrata, from about 400 BCE, in which the women act to stop the wars? Anybody here know how they act? Yeah, they basically cut the men off is what they do. Well, here's my modern take on it, written right after the Women's March here in Astoria. It's called Lysistrata Come Home. It worked in ancient Greece, at least in Aristophanes. Lysistrata, sick of the Peloponnesian War, convinces all the women of Athens and Sparta to cut their men off from sex until war gives way to peace. The women take over the Acropolis, flirting wickedly with the guys outside. The men converge on the Acropolis with giant erections, or so says Aristophanes, begging the women for relief. But they hold out, and guess what? Peace comes. This morning, a friend called, all worked up over a man she likes, but who came by her house wearing the red cap that says, "Make America Great Again." Her pink pussy hat lay in plain view, and she still had on her t-shirt from the Women's March on Washington. They came to verbal blows, him mouthing lies about Obama, her asking, "So what does your wife think of your voting for Trump?" "Not much," he said. "In fact, she cut me off." Of course, things didn't really work out that way in ancient Greece. The Peloponnesian Wars went on for 27 more years. And by that time, nobody cared. But now, if millions of women can march for dignity and light, what if a few thousand stand up to their husbands and lovers with their stiff red caps and say, "That's it for you, Buster." And with all those boners in the balance, who knows? It's worth a better laugh than that. What do you think this is, dignified? But of wit and war and wonder, the greatest among these is surely wonder. Wonder and wildness. Listen to Gerard Manley Hopkins from his 1918 poem, Inversnaid. What would the world be once bereft of wet and wildness? Let them be left, oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. I love that. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. Well, God knows we've still got the wet, at least around here, and some wilderness in a few places yet. These are much of what I write about, after all, in both poetry and in my prose books. But there is no denying that the wild world is much diminished. We've been at war with the world itself, and it is not too strong to say that we have mutilated nature. Yet I have always had a love affair with damaged lands, as I explore in Wintergreen and the Thunder Tree. After all, we can't throw the land away. Even Hanford might as well love it. So when I read this poem by Adam Zagajewski, it truly resonated for me. Try to praise the mutilated world. Remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of rosé wine, the nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watch the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it, while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees going nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and the curtain fluttered? Return in thought to the concert where music flared. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn, and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world, and the gray feather a thrush lost, and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns. I was in Duffy's Irish Pub a few nights ago in Grays River when a young man at the bar whom I didn't know from Camas, recognized me and talked about my book, Where Bigfoot Walks. He spoke to me of what he considered the poetry in my book. Naturally, I was gratified because that's what I earnestly hope for as a writer, finding the lyricism in the prose and the story in the poem. And I guess that's what I'm still looking for as a writer, the place where poetry and prose come together in a plain song for the people, a love song for the land, and a worshipful thank you to whatever is responsible for whatever remains of wonder in the world. And I close with this little poem by Ursula Le Guin, one of the great ambidextrous writers of both poetry and prose, whom we lost only recently. And this is from her last posthumous book, So Far, So Good. Yet still, when fog from the river rises, silent and unforeseen, and the bright morning is all gone, into the uncreated, I rejoice. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and thank you for listening to that much poetry at one time. Well, I think we have a little time for some questions, don't we? Are there any questions or comments or scraps of poetry you'd like to share or anything else? You know, if there are no questions, I have to assume I've imparted the sum total of human knowledge to you, and I think only Humboldt could do that. Yes, Steve.
So, Red and I were up at Quinault, and we took the sort of bus tour of the Ranger, and so...
You're really playing up this retirement thing, aren't you, Steve?
This was quite a while ago. Yep. I was active at the time.
Shepherd's Crook.
What do you think?
Well, Quinault's an area, a great area of potential Bigfoot habitat, and there are a lot of reports in the Quinault, Bogachiel, Queets, and Ho watersheds, many of which are shadows and bears and rocks and alcohol. And
young, these are young, fit rangers.
Yes. It's the ones you get from the young, fit rangers, the loggers, the hunters, the people who are out there a lot. Those are the reports you tend to pay attention to, or to the best biology teacher I ever knew in Washington State. Total skeptic when I went into my project writing Where Bigfoot Walks. I had a Guggenheim for this, which is the strangest thing. If Bigfoot walked in here now, Brenda, and sat in your lap and started feeding you bonbons and reciting 17th century Italian poetry, that would not be as weird as my getting a Guggenheim to write about Bigfoot. Now would it? And but I did, and so my friend Jim, great teacher, total skeptic, called me up and he said, Bob, don't take the fellowship, don't, you know, turn the book down, it'll destroy your life as a writer, you'll never be thought of anything but a Bigfoot writer. I said, Steve, after 6 butterfly books, I'm not worried about being typecast as anything. Anyway, Steve called me up later in the year and he said, Bob, I've seen it, coming down Highway 12, and he saw Bigfoot walk out on the road in the late sun, pee in the road and stride off in the standard fashion into the forest. And he said, Bob, I went from being a Bigfoot total skeptic to a Bigfoot born again in 10 seconds. Those are the kinds of people you listen to. And frankly, the short answer is this. Now, remind me, I was on tour for this book last fall, the new edition of it, which brings things up to date with some new experiences of mine. And one can go on for a very long time about this, and I'm not going to. But the fact is, we know few facts, but one fact is that there is a degree of evidence, if you're willing to use that word, even with a very small e, from the standpoint of tracks, 3 sets of which I have found, for which I do not have a better hypothesis, the canny and smart and sober site reports by people like Young Fit Educated Rangers and Woods Wise Loggers and Hunters and Teachers and so on, that make it foolish for us to dismiss it out of hand, I would say. The great gift to me after my Bigfoot research is, and I was never searching for it, it was never my objective to find it or disprove it or to advocate for it, but I was interested in the whole question of what is the power of this ancient and traditional set of stories that inform all of the Northwest Native American traditions. Does it still have any power or consequence, or have we so diminished it through the tabloids that it has become a joke? That was more my interest, and also to ask as a biologist, could such a phenomenon occur? And I've determined that there are no serious biological objections, biogeographically, evolutionarily, metabolically, this animal could exist. It does exist in the fossil record as Gigantopithecus, if that in fact is what still walks. The gorilla does not occur in the fossil record as far as we know. I mean, it probably does, but it's never been found. So if that's your criterion, there are no gorillas, but there are big feet. You see what I mean? So you put all this together, and it left me with an open mind. And I considered that an extraordinary gift, especially after writing the second edition of the book 20 years later. And frankly, my thoughts are summarized right here, and it's very short, that if we manage to hang on to a sizable hunk of Bigfoot habitat, we will at least have a fragment of the greatest green treasure the temperate world has ever known. And if we do not, Bigfoot, real or imagined, will vanish. And with its shadow will flee the others who dwell in that world. Looking at that tangled bank, one can just about accept that Sasquatch could coexist with towns and loggers and hunters and hikers, all in proportion. But when the topography is finally tamed outright, no one will anymore imagine that giants are abroad on the land. So we might as well treat the land as if it's there. And finally, Steve, on that question, I did bring, just for you, one final poem, which addresses my own feelings on the matter, since nobody will let me get out of here without saying whether I believe or not. Someone said, well, where's your Bigfoot poem? I said, I've never written a poem about Bigfoot. I've just prose. And they said, well, write a Bigfoot poem. So I did. It's called Bigfoot Poem. Professors who have the time of day for Bigfoot are few and far between. There was Professor Holm, UW, told me in 69 that every Indian he knew, still of land and water, had no doubt that Sonequa walks like bear and beaver, thinks us silly even to ask. And Professor Krantz, WSU, keeper of the open mind and greatest hoard of footprint casts and tracks, he broke trail, took academic hell for it. I don't believe, he said, I accept on the evidence. Next came Professor Meldrum, Idaho State U, named a mob of proto-hominids new to science and one fossil species based on footprints, the very ape of whom we speak. There was Professor Napier at the Smithsonian, head of primatology, concluded either Bigfoot was real, which he first thought ridiculous, or a hoax of such elegance as to be impossible, preferred the ridiculous over the impossible. And Professor Goodall of Gombe Forest, who asked me why I was so circumspect in my book. The evidence, said Jane, seems overwhelming to me. So what about you, Professor Pyle? What do you believe? I'm not sure, never having seen one. But those sounds, those tracks, I have no better explanation. I am awaiting word from the final source, but big feet who have the time of day for professors are few and far between. Thank you very much. Now, evening's getting on. I'm going to situate myself over here, and if anyone's interested in taking home an artifact, I will be happy to vandalize it for you so it'll have no further value. I'm going to put a big bunch of ones over there. The prices are listed. Just put down a check or money or an IOU with your name and email. and take your ones for whatever you need, and I'll be here signing. And I did want to mention, by the way, that I do not have with me tonight copies of this book, except for this first advanced reading copy. It's a novel called Magdalena Mountain, and it's my first novel. I've been working on it for 44 years. This is the 10th draft. This is the advanced one that goes out for blurbs and things. I got to sign a few for booksellers the other day, but this will be out in August, and we'll be having an event probably at Kala, so join me for that. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.